British Spy Stories, Season 2, The Kill Order. Episode 8. Schillerstrasse runs west, dead straight, from the dual carriageway to a mass of small streets that crisscross Berlin's Charlottenburg area. Arabelle crashes out of the street door to her block of flats and pulls her scarf around her face to fend off the wind that pours around the office buildings on the corner. She takes a sharp turn left down an alleyway and after 5 minutes disappears in through a purple door under a red neon bar open sign. She navigates the steep stairs down to a long room with a bar running down the back wall. The place is busy at this time in the evening. Groups of drinkers, largely wearing leather. Goths, punks, and bikers among them. The barman has long, deep maroon hair, tied back in a bun. He is pulling bottles from a cupboard to one side and restocking the cold cabinet behind him in a break from the flood of customers. Laravel orders a beer and walks to the far end of the place, where Teresa is sitting on her own at a table for six. Her black hair is in dreadlocks. Her pale green eyes are heavy-lidded and set in a round face with a small mouth.
"What the fuck happened?"
is the woman's opening remark. Then she adds,
"Oh, and I was after your blood."
Laravel sits down exactly opposite her.
"I wasn't even there,"
she says in Russian.
"What are you talking about?"
"When her brother died.
I'm guessing that's why she's pissed off."
"We got the money anyway,"
says Teresa.
"What happened to the passengers?"
Teresa shrugs.
"How do you know about Luana's brother?"
"The driver sent me a message," says Teresa. "He's fucked too because he lost his job with the transport company. So we've got to find another one."
Teresa's voice trails off as she watches something going on in the bar. Suddenly, someone grabs Laravel's hair and pulls her back off the chair. A knife is pushed up against her neck.
"You killed my hype girl,"
it's Oana's voice.
"I wasn't there, Oana. I was in Minsk."
"Don't fuck with me,"
says Oana.
"Honest?"
Laravel's voice is earnest, but not pleading.
"I just made sure he got on board. I had nothing to do with any attack. Who were they, anyway? I risked my fucking life out there for us."
Oana says nothing. Then after a second, releases her grip on Laravel and stows the knife away in her clothing. Only then does Laravel turn to see that Oana had arrived with a man who she doesn't know. The newcomers sit on the same side of the table as Teresa, so it's three of them against one.
"This is Alexandru," says Oana. "He's a friend."
The man looks at Laravel. He's large. His shoulders spread out from a thick neck that holds up a large spherical head with no hair. His eyes are dark like coal on a snowman. The barman delivers more beer to their table, and Oana hands one to Alexandru.
"I had nothing to do with your brother's death, Oana," says Laravel.
She knows that unless they talk about the topic now, it will fester on in the background.
"Some guys with guns just appeared and shot the place up."
No one else says anything.
"Who were they anyway?"
"We don't know,"
says Oana.
"A rival gang?"
"Maybe."
There is an uncomfortable silence, and Laravel realizes the women know more than they're telling her.
"Have you got some enemies that you happen not to mention?"
she says. The Romanian women look at each other, and Teresa makes the faintest nod towards Laravel.
"No, I don't trust her,"
says Oana. Teresa pauses and thinks about her options.
"You need to regain our trust, Sabrina. For all we know, you gave away the route to someone when you were out there playing lovey-dove with your boyfriend." "I'm on your side,"
says Laravel. She can feel sweat on her body.
You'll need to pass a test to prove you're loyal.
Says Teresa.
The gang who killed Mahai are led by a man named Florin Barbu. He controls the Serbian mafia.
What's that got to do with it?
Oana's father was chased by Barbu's associates all the way from Serbia into Belarus before they killed him in cold blood.
What had he done?
Nothing,
says Oana. Alexandru stirs next to her.
They believed falsely that he had grassed them up to the police,
says Teresa.
He was part of Barbu's gang, but he was loyal. He wouldn't have reported them. You said you had contacts here in Berlin, from your time on the game. Barbu has a son. Get your mates to kill the son. Then we're even. And if I don't?
Says Laravel.
The deal when you came into our operation was for life, Sabrina,
says Oana.
It's up to you how long that life lasts.
In the first few seconds that Catherine regains consciousness, she feels fine. Then, gradually, she can feel the pain in her head. Then the pain in her arms. Then the pain in her right leg. She tries to move, but there is tape binding her hands behind her back. She can move her head and looks down at her leg. Her leggings are torn, and there's a long gash in the skin that starts at her ankle and rises across the shin in a red, now congealed, scab of blood. Oddly, only then does she realize that she has a gag tied around her mouth, pulling into the skin on each side. It is dawn. She can tell that from the pattern of light that seeps into the room between one side of the blind and the window frame above her head. She moves her body to see if there's any flexibility in the ties, and she finds a way to slide snake-like across the wooden floor, through the dust. It seems to be a storage room of some sort. Bare floor with walls of patchy white. There are two sets of basic industrial shelves down each sidewall. Catherine shuffles round to see the other side of the room. There's a door in the centre of the wall, but no light beneath the gap at the bottom. Her leg isn't bleeding anymore, but each time she moves it, she opens the scab and pulls apart the skin that creates a shot of pain, but she can't let that stop her. Slowly, slide by slide, she moves towards the window. The sill is low enough for her to pull her head up from the ground and peer under the blind to the world outside. The sun is still rising, but there's enough light to show mountains in the distance and greener, flatter ground immediately around the building that she's in. She can see that she's on the first floor and pulls herself further up to increase her view. There are no people in sight. The place is rural, up in the mountains, somewhere north of Verona, she guesses. But she could be anywhere around the Alps region. It all depends on how long she was unconscious. Catherine knows from training that most likely she will have blacked out for between 6 and 12 hours, which makes this the next morning after the attack. She spends an hour flexing and relaxing the muscles in her arms to gradually work loose the binding. For the first half hour, it doesn't move at all. But after that, she starts to feel some flexing, and she works tirelessly on the tape. She tries to pull one hand out from under the stickiness. The first time she fails, but she repeats the action again and again. As she is starting to feel her arms ache from the repetition, her hand suddenly slips against the tape. She pulls harder, stretching the skin on the back of her hand until she thinks it will be torn off. Her pulse is racing and her hands are bleeding from the abrasions. One last pull, her brain says to her. One last contortion. Catherine yanks her arm to the side, and one hand comes loose. She collapses back onto the floor, pulls off the gag and wipes her hand across her mouth, leaving a red line of blood on her cheek. but a relieved smile on her face. The taxi drops off Marcus Murphy in Grosvenor Square. He walks across to the Biltmore Hotel and into its grand entrance. Sir Bernard is halfway through scrambled eggs and smoked salmon when Marcus arrives at his table in the large tan and auburn decorated dining room. The more senior man raises his hand, and a waiter arrives within 2 seconds.
"Same again for this chap, please," he says.
The waiter silently acknowledges the order and disappears. Murphy sits opposite his boss, and the waiter returns with coffee.
"Nice place," says Marcus.
"My home from home. I stay here whenever I can't get back to Sussex."
"There's some news."
Sir Bernard stops and looks at him.
"Coda."
"What news?"
"Bad news, I'm afraid,"
says Marcus.
"They were attacked with small arms fire, and Coda was hit."
Sir Bernard breathes out through his nose.
"Not good, Marcus. Alive, I take it?"
"Yes, they're working on him in the hospital wing at the airbase in Poland. He's comfortable."
"Who were the attackers?"
"We don't know."
"There can't be that many groups who would want to attack an SAS extraction."
Marcus tries not to show what he's thinking.
"And how did they find out?"
Sir Bernard drops his voice, but the intensity is still like fire across the table.
"Black Hawk is on it, sir."
"Thank God for something,"
he says. His emotions are not dying away.
"Who knew about this op?"
"It was handled through London Centre, sir. Just like normal,"
says Murphy.
"So anyone with access to control logs?"
The waiter brings Murphy's food and he starts to eat, while Sir Bernard thinks about the options they have.
"Bring in Ella Perrotts,"
he says finally.
"You know her?"
"Not personally, sir."
"Bloody good researcher. She's the head of department in investigations branch and still in her 20s.
"Yes, sir."
"You need full root and branch intel on what went on. How the details of an SAS extraction order can have got out."
Sir Bernard pauses momentarily.
"Now, about your other issue, Marcus. Your blue flag on Coniston. You were sending Riverside."
"He arrives later today, sir."
"Any intel on her situation?"
"Not yet, sir."
"Marcus, you need to pressure the boys and girls to move more quickly. We have 3 ops that are at risk in the last 3 days. You need to be more on top of things."
"Yes, sir."
"Are you coping, Marcus?"
"I am, sir,"
says Murphy, with some doubt in his own mind about how true that is. After untying herself, Catherine explores the house where she is being held. The downstairs floor is an apartment that looks like it is hired out to holidaymakers in the summer months. She finds a box of cereal, pasta, and a working stove, and she cooks a meal of pasta and cornflakes, which tastes better than she imagined it would. She has discovered that her leg is more damaged than she first thought, and it gives her a limp as she explores the property. The wound is deep and needs medical attention soon, or it will get infected. Catherine hunts through the cupboards in the house for any sort of medical supplies. There's nothing in the kitchen, the lounge, or the bedrooms. At last, in the garage, she finds a red plastic medical box at the bottom of a drawer and rips it open with elation, but it contains only half a packet of plasters and a nearly empty tube of antiseptic. In her anger, she throws the box across the garage, and it crashes into the far wall and splits in two. She breathes deeply and talks to herself to get her head in order. She's a trained fighter, and this should be nothing to her. But the injury and the remoteness have got to her somehow. She has no transport, her phone has gone, as well as her wallet and her handgun. She hits the side of her temple, trying to get her psyche back to a functioning level. It's then that she hears the sound of an approaching engine. Catherine runs back into the house and continues up the stairs. She looks out of the window on the landing. A dark SUV is driving off the road and onto the patchy grass that surrounds the immediate land around the house. The car trips the switch on the outside light, which floods the space with illumination. The vehicle stops, and one man gets out. He is of medium height, has curly brown hair, and an innocent face. He has a Makarov 18mm pistol stuffed into his belt. This tells her he is either Russian military, or has bought guns from the Russians on the black market. He is wearing a short jacket, blue jeans, and steel-capped combat boots. She needs to think quickly. Her leg prevents her from attacking him one-on-one, which would have been her preferred plan. She returns to the room where she was tied up, lays down in the dust, pulls her arms back behind her, and closes her eyes. She can hear the sound of the man climbing up the staircase. Then she hears him waiting. Then the sound of the door to the room opening. Her breaths are low, but steady. She holds her body dead still. She hears him walk over to her and drop down on his haunches. She feels his hand brush her hair from her face. He says nothing. After 30 agonizing seconds, he gets up, walks back to the door, and locks it behind him. She stays still, knowing the trick of appearing to leave a room to test if your prisoner is pretending to be unconscious. Time ticks on. 1 minute. 2 minutes. She opens her eyes. The room is empty.